Chapter 24. Tilly. Looking back, I'm embarrassed to say that I did not take the news well or maturely. I thrashed about angrily for weeks and, frankly, acted like a spoiled child who has come to believe that she is no longer Daddy's favorite. My sexual relationship with Blair Gaines came to an abrupt end, although I continued to see him after hours. He would frequently ask for my company, calling me on my phone between his meetings and in the mornings on the way to his work. I took every opportunity to deny his requests, as rudely and as forcefully as possible. He was in love, and I used that against him shamelessly, unable to have such vengeful feelings and not actually exercise them. But then, after refusing him, I would generally show up at his place at the end of the day anyway, brooding and petulant, as though I was doing him a favor against my wishes. And each time, I was warmly received. In those days, Blair took of me whatever little was available to be had, mostly my poor company. It would have been better for both of us if I had simply taken the news and left him. The few friends to whom I had entrusted knowledge of my relationship with Blair all counseled me to never see him again. My mother would have certainly given the same advice had I ever told her about Blair, although it would have been less advice than histrionic lecture, heavily seasoned with concerns about my reputation and the media and my father's reaction to it all, which would have ultimately segued into how the scandals of my life affect her. It's not easy seeing those tabloids, Tilly. It's not easy talking to our friends when that sort of news comes out. Your father shuts himself off from the world and won't talk to me about anything. Like, somehow it's all my fault. I'm all for sex, Tilly. I'm no prude, but... As far as my mother was concerned, I never let on that my relationship with Blair was anything more than actor and director. In fact, my discussions about Blair had always quite deliberately tended to emphasize his romantically repellent qualities, his short temper and his arrogance, and that distinctive Australian chauvinism. Her relief at these assessments was so obvious that I could never have told her the truth about us. But, for the record, my mother's advice would have been the same. Take the news and either fight it or lump it, but never go back to Blair. Good advice, except that I could not take the news. The news was utterly unacceptable. So I stayed close, railing at Blair and making a point of withholding everything that he wanted from me. Things that I had long since stopped giving with an open heart. He looked like a whipped puppy most of the time, apologizing profusely and offering his sympathies and promising me better work on future projects. He took to confessing his love on a regular basis and pleaded with me to see the larger picture, explaining in unnecessary detail what I already knew about the state of his separation from his wife and their mutual desire to make it formal. But while Blair had shed his indomitable authoritarian persona in my presence, adopting in its place a weak and endlessly accommodating temperament that did nothing to improve his chances, He also never changed his mind about recasting the film. However much he loved me, he was truer to his art. However much he needed Angus Mann more. Blair's obsession with me was not compelling enough to dislodge his greater obsession with pulling the heart of Angus Mann into the film that loomed ever larger in his mind. He needed Angus. And Angus had his conditions. Lost to me in all the drama of my meltdown was the real reason I could not bring myself to leave Blair Gaines. The truth was that we both needed Angus Mann, and were both unwilling to let him go. Somewhere inside the cauldron of my anger was the quiet knowledge that Blair Gaines was the only connection I had to Angus, and that to abandon one was to forsake the other. Even if some undeserving harlot of the week was chosen to replace me as Colonel Elena Ivanova, and even if I had no part in the project whatsoever, I was unwilling, unable, to simply walk away. For reasons that are clear to me now, after years of reflection, but which were a mystery to me back then, I needed him. I actually needed the Ohioan writer of books and stories whose contempt for me and my talents and my life were always so plain on his face. I would like to be able to claim that Angus's obvious disdain for my character did not matter, and that somehow I needed him despite his disapproval. But I cannot make any such claim. For his disdain for my character did matter. And the truth is that I needed him then because of his disapproval. In my own defense, though my manner of expression certainly left much to be desired, I did have reason to be upset. I had invested a great deal of my time and energy in the Lion Tree. And while I cannot say that it caused me to forgo any other particular opportunities, it rankled me to see my effort put to waste. That, and yet something still much greater. I have never been an automaton. Acting has never been about pretending. For me. Quite the contrary. Acting has always been more about finding and expressing the parts in myself that are buried too deeply for me to reach on my own. I remember Angus telling me outside of his hotel, after he had disappeared and I was so worried about him, that writers and actors are the same, in that we are enslaved by the characters we create. And while I dismissed him at the time, I knew there was a real truth in what he said. We do not become our characters necessarily, but we, the actor and the writer, do forge strong and intensely intimate relationships with them. Because while they are not us exactly, they come from our very essence, and there is nothing about us that they do not know. Something of my soul went into learning Ivanova and in bringing her to life. It was hard work that I was both proud of and moved by. We had bonded, she and I. We understood each other in mysterious ways that I could never have articulated. For Blair to so abruptly take her back as though she were only a costume or a mask, as though she and I had not already forged a strong symbiotic identity, was impossible to accept. I was not the only actor upset. We were all upset. Even the normally slow-to-burn pretty boy Casey Travern, who had counted on his role as Lieutenant Miller to broaden his screen appeal. Blair's recasting decision sparked a mini-boom among Los Angeles entertainment lawyers, as agents and actors went the way of the erstwhile screenwriters and retained high-priced firms to vent their outrage. I too went in that direction, but not with much conviction. Contract rights were nowhere near the heart of my concern, and I knew that lawsuits would not change anything important. Blair was never particularly concerned about the liability issues. After all, it was only a matter of money. And for all the vituperative chest beating, the claims did not amount to all that much in the scheme of things. Most of them were paid off in fairly short order. Besides, legal claims from a handful of disgruntled actors were the least of Blair's problems. Filming came to a full stop while Blair and Angus reworked the script, and it was to be nearly 5 months before production resumed. Union agreements had to be renegotiated. Supply contracts had to be canceled and penalties paid. The recasting decision was the last straw for all but one of the producers who abandoned the project, canceling their funding commitments and demanding their investments be returned with interest. I feared the project was completely dead. But Blair was a man possessed and would not let go. His clout attracted other investors, and with a sizable contribution from his own personal fortune, he was able to plug the holes and start again. Although, it must be said, he did not start over completely. He kept the Africa scenes. Partly, Blair was pleased with the way those scenes turned out, and he did not think he was going to be able to improve on them. Also, the Africa scenes did not involve any of the main characters in the story, so he knew he could keep that footage without implicating the new casting decisions. Just as in the original story, the Africa scenes were like a self-contained dream upon which the main characters reflected, but in which they did not directly participate. I also think Blair chose to save the Africa scenes because he did not want to have to return to that place without me. This is not something he ever said to me, but whenever he spoke of those weeks in Tozeur and Mombasa, and of our nights on the veranda, on the high ground of his island, drinking wine and pulling Nyama Choma from the bone with our teeth and our stained fingers, and listening to the dark sea serenading the beach beyond the circle of torches, it was with a great and almost wistful fondness. That was back when I found him ferocious and unforgiving and savagely inaccessible. Back when I could not resist him. He knew he could never go back to that Africa. So he did not start over completely. And it is also not quite right to say that he recast the entire movie. It is more accurate to say that he and Angus were prepared to end up with an entirely new cast. All the actors were fired. That is true. But they were not precluded from re-auditioning for any of the roles, along with the rest of the acting world. It was conceivable from the beginning, therefore, that a member of the old cast would be selected again, for either the same or a different role. Blair repeatedly assured me that he, personally, did not have a problem with my performance, although he expressed general agreement with Angus that they needed a fresh start. Either he did not know or chose not to tell me what Angus thought of my performance. He did encourage me to re-audition for the part of Ivanova, an invitation I repeatedly and dramatically rejected. "What's the point?" I shouted at him from out on his balcony, my back to the lights of Los Angeles. "You say you liked my performance. If you're telling me the truth, then just cast me and stop making me jump through extra hoops. And if you don't like my performance, then just tell me and spare me the humiliation of an audition that you will simply flush down the toilet. And if that's the case, by the way, if you really don't like my work, then fuck you, because I know that character. I know her, Blair. I nailed that role, and I know what I'm doing. And if you can't see that, then
it's not up to me, Tilly John, he said,
sitting down on the bed and rubbing his forehead in his palms. I came inside, slamming the door behind me. Bullshit! You're not auditioning for your own movie?
We each have a veto. Angus will do the first audition and will pass on to me anyone who meets with his approval. Then I will audition from that group. I don't have to accept anyone I do not like, and he does not have to accept anyone he does not like.
That's insane, Blair.
Audition, Tilly. If you can convince Angus that you know Ivanova as much as you believe you do, then he will pass you up to me, and I won't make you audition again. I promise. You've already proven yourself to me, love.
Don't call me that.
Tilly, please. You want me to call your agent? I'll call Milton.
Oh, leave Milton out of this. This is insane. Since when does Angus Mann know the first goddamn thing about acting?
He doesn't. Angus wants... It's important to Angus that the actors...
What?
That they really understand the essence of the characters. That they really get the importance of the greater context. You know? It's all about the story for Angus. He's trying to maintain the integrity of what he has written. And I have to concede that...
Oh. Of all the self-important bullshit, Blair. The guy really needs to get over himself and come to grips with the fact that he sold his little story. It's yours now.
Nah, Tilly. The studio owns it, yes, but it's always his story. I respect that.
Well, isn't that just incredibly fucking honorable of you?
It has nothing to do with honor. It's just the way it is.
Right. Angus hates me.
He doesn't hate you, Tilly John. If he hated you, then he'd have blacklisted you.
He has a blacklist?
Yes.
Who?
Not you. And that's all I'm saying. He could have if he hated you, as you say. But he didn't.
So, you have discussed names?
Yes.
For Ivanova.
For everybody, Tilly.
There's a blacklist for Ivanova.
Yes.
Did you talk about me for the part?
Yes. We talked about a lot of people.
What did he say?
You have to reapply, like anyone else. No favors.
No favors. No favors? God damn it, Blair. I already have the part.
Tilly, come sit down.
He patted the bed next to him. No. I opened the door and walked back out onto the balcony to watch the city burn like phosphorus glittering in a black wave.
He didn't exclude you, Blair said. He could have. You've got a leg up. If you want the role, you should audition. If you don't, I'll make a film just for you, Tilly.
I don't want your charity, Blair.
Okay, Tilly. Okay.
He sat there for several minutes and let me fume. Eventually, he stood and joined me on the balcony, enveloping me from behind in his arms. I wanted to shrug him off and almost did, but I was not completely without pity. All attraction was gone for me, but I was still human, and Blair was crumbling before my eyes like dry sand.
It's all going to be okay,
he said, burying his face in my hair. Not unexpectedly, after long moments of silence, his hands began to work the buttons of my blouse. I did not resist him this time. I should have resisted. I had vowed not to give in. But in that moment, I felt overcome by a mixture of fatigue and compassion that made resistance impossible. When he had undressed me completely, I stood naked and still and impassively in the night air, the room behind him blazing yellow, and let his eyes pull the meat from the bone. He undressed and tried to take me inside to the bed, but I refused. He was willing to take anything I was willing to offer. But I simply could not offer anything so connubial as a bedded lovemaking. It was not in me. But my pity for him, and not a small amount of self-loathing, got me to the railing of the balcony. What do I have to do? I asked after he was done, and the dissatisfaction was slowly coming back into his eyes.
About what?
I shook out my camisole and pulled it over my head. I pointed to my blouse, laying in a heap by the door. He pulled it up with a finger and handed it to me. About auditioning, I said. He looked up at me with some surprise.
Just curious,
I warned.
I'll get you the packet.
Blair left his clothes scattered across the balcony and went downstairs. He returned with a manila envelope.
Answer the questions and give it back to me,
he said, a little out of breath.
I'll get it to Angus.
I want to see him.
No. He's not seeing anyone. Not even you. He's working. Don't bother him.
You're not my father, Blair. I'll see him if I want to see him.
He's changed hotels, Tilly. You don't know where he is. If you're really interested, you've got to fill this out and get it back to me.
What is it?
It's a questionnaire about the story.
Christ. What? Multiple choice? Do I need a number 2 pencil?
Sorry. They're all essay. He wants you to compose your thoughts so he can see what you think about things.
He's auditioning for writers, I said, scanning the pages of questions.
Not quite. He's auditioning people who think like writers. He's auditioning for depth of understanding. He doesn't like actors much.
I'm an actor, Blair.
Yes, Tilly John. You are an actor.
So?
So he doesn't agree.
The sheaf of questions stayed in the manila envelope, and the envelope stayed on my kitchen table undisturbed for 10 full days. During that time, I banished Angus from my thoughts and I did not see or speak to Blair even once, though he tried incessantly to speak to me. I did not return his calls. I erased his messages. Blair knew better than to show up on my doorstep, and I was grateful for that. For 10 days, I endeavored to lose myself completely in the celebrity social scene that I had never really enjoyed in the first place. My friends, Martina and Chad and Zoe and the rest of the group, were shocked to find me suddenly so available. And though I found their good-natured ribbing annoying,
Tilly, what's gotten into you? Are you feeling all right? Has hell frozen over already?
It was also understandable. In high school and college, I completely burned out my social impulses. That louder, faster, higher, wilder, try anything, do anything, party till you pop, dance till you die engine of youthful rebellion that seemed sometimes like it would just never stop. But it did stop. The irony was never lost on me that when I moved to California and started to make it in Hollywood, where the party scene exploded at my feet like a free carnival, I was increasingly disinclined to participate. I suspect that this was because public socializing was suddenly expected of me by my culture, my profession, my agent, my friends, and even my mother, all of them pushing, pushing.
You've got to be out there and be seen, Tilly. Get some attention, Tilly. Rub some shoulders, Tilly.
My contrarian nature instinctively just dug in its heels. My hermitage, at least by Hollywood standards, was doubly reinforced by the "you are who you know" ethic of self-worth. To to which both of my parents tended to subscribe as I was coming up as a defiant, button-pushing teenage beast. I have grown up loathing the idea of going someplace just because someone worth meeting or being seen with might be there. It is for this reason that the story of my adolescence brims with overly close associations with people absolutely not worth meeting or being seen with. The most rebellious thing one can do in Hollywood is to choose to be alone. So I suppose it might have been rebellious impulses still guiding me. For whatever the quality of my reputation among the tabloid readers, I earned a reputation among my closer friends as an aspiring recluse who liked a simple, even if self-indulgent, routine, and who always had an endless list of creative reasons that prevented my attendance. This was a completely alien disposition for my friends. With the exception of Chad Donnelly, who had a regular part in a daytime soap and was something of a heartthrob in his own right, very few of them were actors. Most of them tended to come from the post-production industry. Martina and Lucas were in catering. Rich was a CGI geek. It is remarkable, I suppose, that while my social setting changed dramatically upon moving to California, my compulsion to associate with the wrong crowd never did. Everything is relative, of course. These were all smart, beautiful people without a single felony conviction or infected piercing among them. But they all lived in the shadows of the in-crowd just the same. I was the only one among them with a real Tinseltown ticket. And to have both a ticket and a disinclination to make any use of the ticket was to my friends both an affront to the laws of social Darwinism and a waste of access, which, in my business, was more important than food and water. They tended to float around me like a school of hungry, frustrated cleaner fish. Needless to say, when I suddenly started to swim out in more congested waters, my friends came alive, working in shifts to plan elaborate party tours around Los Angeles. My friends tended to know the when, the where, and the who, and my job was to supply the access. Over a week and a half, a rough pattern emerged that included late afternoon fare at some shishi cafe in Beverly Hills or Century City, followed by a party at somebody's home up in Brentwood or Bel Air, or tucked up into the folds of Laurel Canyon, looking out over the starlit San Fernando Valley, followed by drinking, dancing, and flirting our way through the VIP rooms up and down the boulevard and around West Hollywood until the early morning. My suggestions for something a little off-center? Silver Lake, Los Feliz, or even the relatively less gentrified Echo Park were roundly rejected. Only the mainstream Hollywood gauntlet would suffice. Each night was a riff on the same general theme, as though we were making a glitzy video brochure promoting the hedonistic excesses of movie star lifestyle. The Robin Leach voiceover was missing, but little else. It did not take long for the paparazzi, hungry for even minor celebrity sightings, to pick up the scent and start photo documenting our every move. It took 3 months for the ensuing rumor of a tryst between me and Chad to lose its steam, though I could claim neither indignation nor surprise. I confess that, as Chad and I were working off too many Manhattans in a less than conservative fashion, I could not help but imagining Angus's reaction at the supermarket checkout line. Not that he would be jealous in any sense, for I had no reason to believe Angus had any charitable feelings for me at all. Rather, I knew it would only confirm his impressions. The part of me I did not understand, the part of me with the silver tongue and the velvet voice that seduced my self-destructive impulses into the shadows, was aiming squarely for unmitigated contempt. My fair-weather coterie understood that my window for social abandon would be open for only a short time, and they were determined to make the most of it. They did not understand why the window had opened in the first place, and, frankly, neither did I, except that I had felt trapped and needed to escape the incomprehensible. So that's what I did, night after night, wading into the sparkling, shallow madness, like the tiny rising star I was supposed to be, and trying to shake feelings that would not let go. In the end, my 10-day social rebellion against my anti-social rebellion did not take. It amounted to nothing more than a painful distraction. I did not like the muscled merriment or the wall-to-wall over-stylized conviviality. I did not like the people. I did not like the music. And I did not like the endless questions about what the hell Blair Gaines thought he was doing with that movie of his. In 10 days, I was referred to 6 different lawyers. So, day 11 found me back at home, restless and brooding about everything I had tried to tell myself no longer mattered. The packet, as Blair had called it, consisted of 15 pages of questions on the subject of The Lion Tree by Angus Mann. Each page stated 2 questions, usually no more than 2 lines each, one question appearing at the top and another appearing half page. The questions were typed, not printed. The H and the R did not take the ink. The periods looked like little half moons around a crater of graying white space. As I read the questions, cursorily at first, then each with great care, I could not help but imagine Angus disheveled in a cloud of blue smoke, typing them out at a little desk next to an unmade hotel bed and a tray of half-eaten food, with a bottle of something amber-colored sitting in front of a silver dataport wall jack, for which he would never have any use. I imagined a knock at the door, which he does not answer, and when the hotel maid stops abruptly in surprise at the sight of him, hunched over his little table in poor light, he waves her away like a fly, and he continues working, bent over his typewriter like he is bent over a hole in the earth, pulling something precious and painful up through the hole and into the world for the first time. I did not attempt to answer any of the questions. Not at first. I pulled out my copy of The Lion Tree and read it again. And when I was done, I started over at the beginning. And as I read, I could hear Elena Ivanova calling to me from between the words, from way out there on Rutan Baker, from beneath a dome, where the light that comes from everywhere and from nowhere, and that glops heavily upon the failing crops of corn and sorghum, is lifeless and suffocating. calling to me from between the words, where she is alone with a man who loves her, but who does not understand his own annihilative compulsions in matters of love. I could hear Elena Ivanova calling to me from her own emotional exile, from that place in the heart where pain and loneliness and death grow from well-intentioned seedlings of self-preservation. When I was done reading, I answered Angus Mann's questions. I used a black pen at the kitchen table, scrawling out my responses on the questionnaire, using the backs of the pages, and attaching extra sheets as necessary, knowing that however much my penmanship lacked, Angus would find it infinitely preferable to the sterility of Times New Roman. I wrote for 2.5 uninterrupted hours, thoroughly engrossed, sitting next to a glass of wine I had poured, but never came up for air long enough to drink. Now and then, I felt like I was back at Wesleyan, writing my final exams on all of the great works of all the great dead novelists who knew how to bend over dark holes in the earth and pull something precious and painful out onto the surface of the world. In those moments of slippage back into the rigors of academe, I felt an instinctive urge to critique Angus's story. More than simply expounding upon its themes and demonstrating my understanding of its structural tension and the motivations of its characters. I am glad to say, for my own sake, that I successfully resisted that urge. For I know, as I knew then, that Angus was not looking for criticism, but understanding. He had saved the best for last.
As succinctly as possible, describe the tragic truth of Colonel Ivanova and Lieutenant Miller.
I stood up from the table and drank my wine. I paced my home in slow circles, staring at my bare feet as they emerged in turn from my nightgown and covered fresh carpet. I imagined Angus at his typewriter, arms crossed now, waiting for an answer. I walked out into the cool pre-dawn stillness that had settled over the world and finished my wine. The grass was damp beneath my feet, and it gave me a wet chill that I felt rising up each leg, and then slowly up my spine. I gazed up at the silent storming of stars that burned down through not only the blackness of space, but also through the dome of electric luminescence that, even in the far end of night, encased the city. I thought about Colonel Ivanova and Lieutenant Miller, alone together on one of those faraway points of light, under a translucent shield, like two pills beneath a wad of cotton at the bottom of a medicine bottle. I thought of Blair Gaines, miles away in his bed, dreaming in fits, and of how I had once loved him, and how now, like a star winking out, I no longer did. I thought of my father, and of never having pet fish, and of betrayal. And I thought of Angus waiting for me on an African savanna between the hole in the earth and the lion tree. I returned to the papers on my table, my feet wet on the wood floor of the kitchen. Without even sitting, I found the pen, bent over, and wrote out my answer. Love will not be banished, nor longing consumed. Fate's reserved for the heart and the will.